From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a look at the smoothest regime change Ford Motor Company has ever had.
This is really a first for Ford Motor Company, and you can tell that Bill Ford is particularly proud of that.
Plus, why Kalamazoo's become such a literary hotspot.
You know, college students are having poetry readings on their front porches, and it's a really good atmosphere to be a creative person in.
We talk with the outgoing librarian for the state of Michigan.
None of us in libraries went into it for the money, but as a career, it's very rewarding.
And a napping station at a college library?
So the idea is that instead of falling asleep at the table, they could get up and, you know, stumble over to the napping station, fall down on a cot, and take their nap there.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Ford Motor Company announced this morning at the automaker's Dearborn headquarters, the Glass House, that CEO Alan Mulally is stepping down July 1st. The 68-year-old Mulally will be replaced by Ford's current chief operating officer, Mark Fields. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we look at a first for Ford Motor Company, a seamless top executive transition. Then later this hour, Michigan has a state bird and a state tree, of course. But did you know we have a state library? We'll talk with Michigan's outgoing state librarian about the future of reading in libraries in this ever-digital world. But first, Kevin Orr has wrapped up his 2 days of meetings with lawmakers in Lansing. His goal? Winning support for some $350 million as the state's share in that so-called grand bargain. But let's shift our focus now to money, not from the state capital, but the nation's capital. Republicans and even some Democrats are dead set against the idea of a federal bailout for Detroit. GOP Senator David Vitter of Louisiana last fall tried and failed, we might note, to get a law passed to prevent federal money from ever going to the city.
When you look at situations like Detroit, the largest ever municipal bankruptcy, and when you look at our fiscal situation in Washington at the federal level, this clear statement, this clear bar of the feds bailing out state and local government is very, very much needed.
But we wondered, are the tides changing even a bit, even slowly? The Obama administration and officials in Michigan are in talks to give Detroit $100 million federal dollars for blight remediation. And late last week, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew visited Detroit. So we wanted to talk about that with Detroit Free Press D.C. reporter Todd Spangler. Todd, is it fair to say we are seeing a shift, albeit subtle, towards some federal dollars to help Detroit?
Well, I think that if there is any shift, it is a very subtle one. What has become clear is that the federal government, the Treasury, is still not going to just sign a check for Detroit. It seems like what's really in the works here is there's a lot of money wrapped up in blight eradication that could be made available to Detroit, and that if the state, particularly, were to ask the feds for that, there might be a possibility of getting some of that money for Detroit, which then could be used to offset money the city was already going to be putting into blight to be used to help retirees and other things that are needed through this bankruptcy settlement.
So it almost sounds like a little bit of a shell game.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we'll give it to the state to give, you know, and we'll call it, it's blight removal, so it's not a bailout. But if it kind of looks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Sure. I mean, but that's the case really throughout the country. I mean, there were some 18 states that supposedly got money through this, what's called the hardest hit fund, mm-hmm. back in 2010. And you know, Michigan got upwards of $500 million for that to be used around the state. But only a small portion of that ever got used. That was for mortgage rescue programs and to keep people in their homes. And while some of that got used, a lot of it didn't. And lately there has been this thought maybe that it could be turned around to be used for things that states need, like in Michigan and particularly in Detroit and Flint and places like that, mm-hmm. to tear down, you know, buildings to get rid of blight. That requires Treasury to say, yes, it's okay to use that money that way. No one in the state has come back to the feds yet, at least officially, to say, we want that money. We want another $100 million for Detroit, that Detroit could use that money for use a like amount of money for something else. But we understand there have been conversations and discussions going on, you know, to that effect. Whether that will happen or not remains to be seen. And Treasury is very careful to say no one's asked them for any money yet, and they're not giving $100 million to anybody as of right now.
You know, we know that Mayor Duggan met with President Obama when the president came to Lansing to sign the farm bill. He took Vice President Joe Biden to dinner at the Eastern Market when the Veep was in town to see the auto show last January.
Yes.
Is this FaceTime, do you think, paying off for Mike Duggan and Detroit?
It can't help but pay off for the mayor. Listen, the Michigan is a state in a circumstance with a Republican governor, and a Democratic White House, by its very nature, while it wants to be supportive of Michigan and of Detroit, is going to be somewhat wary of giving too much support to Rick Snyder in a year when he's running against, you know, a Democrat who's been endorsed by the UAW, who's a key ally of this White House.
Sure.
What can break that kind of balance when it comes to all kinds of things, whether it's, you know, money for a customs plaza for a new bridge, or whether it's help for, you know, programs as Detroit goes through bankruptcy, is Mike Duggan. I mean, if he can establish a relationship, a working relationship with President Obama and Biden and the Treasury, maybe more importantly, and I don't mean one with Congress as much as with the sort of the people who with their hands on the levers of power in the White House, that can make a huge difference.
Yeah, and that's what I kind of wondered, if there is a growing sense that the powerful people in Washington are looking at Duggan and Kevin Orr, but maybe even there they, you know, maybe they might want to admit it, but Governor Snyder, and maybe there's more trust than there was for Dave Bing and Kwame Kilpatrick.
There is definitely a lot of trust there for Governor Snyder. I mean, there is no question that this White House feels that when they have looked to work with Governor Snyder, he has been easy to get along with. I mean, that's not to say they agree on everything by a long shot, but that, you know, when they have looked for a partner in Michigan, it hasn't, you know, the governor has not met them, as have some other Republican governors, you know, with the closed door.
With the pitchforks. And
exactly.
Yeah. And we've seen that he has been proactive in pledging Michigan's share to the grand bargain, although that still has to get through the legislature. But you certainly get the sense that there's a willingness to kind of work across the fences.
Well, I think there has to be. I mean, Governor Snyder, when he was elected 4 years ago, did not get elected by a state that, you know, was predominantly red, even in, you know, in non-presidential years. Mm. It's even those years, it's a purple state. And I think Governor Snyder is very much someone who realizes if you're going to be elected and reelected governor, it requires a certain amount of Democratic votes, and that means being seen as somebody who's willing to work on issues and maybe not be quite so ideological about them.
Todd, what should we read into the Treasury Secretary's trip to Detroit last week?
I think it was a signal. I mean, I think that there is a great desire on the part of the U.S. Treasury, of the White House, to show that it is a partner to Detroit. I think that It wants to be able to show where it's working to try to help, how it's trying to help Detroit spend the money it gets. If money needs to be repackaged, perhaps this $100 million is something that will get repackaged down the line, that they are willing to try to help Detroit in any way possible other than signing a check that just says, here's a bailout for Detroit. That's not going to happen. The Congress, particularly the House, would put the brakes on that as fast as they possibly could.
Yeah.
And for what it's worth, even this Democratic administration does not want to do that. They realize very well the trials that would go along with handing out money to cities that are in financial trouble, because there's a lot of them across the country.
Right. It isn't just a Detroit story. But it certainly seems as though a politically wise administration strategist would figure out a way to lend a helping hand to Detroit that would not need any approval by Congress.
Absolutely. And there are always streams of revenue that can be used, like happened, you know, last year, where the state, I mean, with the feds and local leaders, et cetera, put together this $300 million package. A lot of that money had already been authorized. It just hadn't been used. It hadn't been set up in such a way that the city could get it quickly. They went out of the way to change that and still got around the idea that they were bailing out Detroit.
So are you willing to hazard a guess, Todd, on the likelihood of Detroit getting federal money?
I think the likelihood of Detroit getting federal money is extraordinarily good. Where that federal money will come from, how much it will be, what kind of strings will be attached to it, who knows? That's really sort of what's up in the air. And remember, This is money that's coming, that's going to be used in out years and years and years to come, which is really what Detroit's looking for, money that's going to help balance its budget down the road. You know, this could be months or even longer in the future before money were to be authorized. It would still have the same effect of helping Detroit.
Speaking of just looking at the timeline of things, I would suspect, again, if I was a smart White House strategist, getting that into Detroit's pipeline before the elections would be a smart thing.
Well, it would certainly help in certain ways. I mean, if you know, there's a big Senate race in Michigan, you probably heard.
You think?
Yeah. And I think it's not lost on the White House or anybody that the Michigan seat in the Senate could help decide whether or not the Democrats remain the majority or the Republicans become the majority in the Senate. And, you know, does money from a Democratic administration and visits from the Treasury Secretary and others potentially help a Democrat? It very well might.
Detroit Free Press D.C. reporter Todd Spangler. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Todd. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What city would get your vote as one of Michigan's literary hotspots? My next guest would give her vote to Kalamazoo. Anna Clark recently wrote about the city's literary scene. Good to have you here.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
So what made you decide you were going to write a story and pinpoint Kalamazoo as such a literary hotspot?
Well, the easiest answer is because it is a literary hotspot. You know, there is amazing things happening there for both writers and readers. For myself as a literary enthusiast and spending a lot of time in creative writing communities, fiction communities, poetry communities, Kalamazoo keeps coming up. And this is not just locally. I did an MFA program in Asheville, North Carolina. And, you know, folks who are thinking about going on to do a PhD in creative writing and literature would often think about Western Michigan University, which is one of the few universities that offers that. It's been a center for that I think a lot of writers do know about, but it hasn't necessarily spread beyond that. The news of it hasn't quite spread beyond that. I think a lot of Michiganders should know and get excited about
it. Yeah. So the word is spread around the nation and the writing community. So this isn't just in Michigan we think this. You're saying you're hearing this elsewhere.
Absolutely. And a lot of the folks that I talk to who are in Kalamazoo right now, many of them have deep roots in the community, but many chose to come there from elsewhere.
For example, you talked to a woman who came from New York City, mm-hmm. which, you know, one might think, oh, if I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it in New York. And she grew up there and said, I'm in Kalamazoo. Why? What is it about Kalamazoo that drew her and keeps her here? And who are we talking about?
I think that one is Thisbe Nissen, mm-hmm. though she's certainly not the only New Yorker who found her way to Kalamazoo. But she is an accomplished fiction writer who made her way to Western to teach. That's when she started making her life there. And she's married to another writer who also, I think, spends her time there. And what she told me is that she was especially interested in the people of the community. You know, she felt like these were lives worth telling, that people talked about things that she wanted to write about. She told me that she drew a lot of inspiration from the talent that was in the area, certainly in the writing programs, but even beyond that, she was really excited about the fact that there was such a genuine literary enthusiasm that, you know, college students are having poetry readings on their front porches. And it's a really good atmosphere to be a creative person in.
So give us a sense of some of the writers who hang their hats in Kalamazoo. Certainly Bonnie Jo Campbell is a premier Michigan writer, mm-hmm. who's made quite a reputation.
Yeah, she's extraordinary. She's extraordinary, and a lot of her fiction also is very much, you know, of that place, American Salvage, mm-hmm. and Once Upon a River. You know, and she clearly draws a lot of inspiration from the area. But she is one among many names. So Stuart Dybeck is really well known for his roots in Kalamazoo. He was a real linchpin in the Western's creative writing program. And while he lives elsewhere now, he mm-hmm. still teaches master classes there and has connections there. There's David Small, who was very much celebrated for his graphic novel, except it was nonfiction. I'm not sure what the phrase is for that. Stitches, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also a Caldecott-winning illustrator who collaborates a lot with his wife, Sarah Stewart. They're famous for a whole number of children's books. Thisbe Nissen, of course. There's Diane Seuss, who's a poet. There's so many, I couldn't name them all right now.
and so they've got that going on. But if you're a consumer of good writing, there's plenty in Kalamazoo.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ways you could connect to the book community as a passionate reader. So there's several independent bookstores in the area that are very much engaged. They do a lot of events. They have really knowledgeable staff to, like, work with you and help you find the books you're going to love. There's the Friends of Poetry organization, which amplifies poetry throughout the community in a whole number of ways. There's the Kalamazoo Book Arts Center, which is very committed to the craft of books, you know, letterpress and design and things like that. They host the Edible Book Festival every year.
great title,
isn't it? You know, it's so fun. They do it's a very interesting way to celebrate literary culture. So there's a whole number of things. And, of course, the writing programs at Kalamazoo College and Western have, reading series and Third Coast, the literary journal. There's books published by New Issues Press. Several bars, including Bell's Brewery, regularly host literary events. You know, so this is really, you know, a very multifaceted, multidimensional literary community. It's not like you go to one place and the whole of it is housed there. This is happening in a lot of different corners of Kalamazoo.
And as you point out in your story for the Free Press, certainly having Western Michigan University and Kalamazoo College there has helped to coalesce a lot of writers and a lot of different type of writers. But you kind of point to things in the history of Kalamazoo that help this. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was some interesting meditation that Bonnie Jo Campbell, especially sort of thought about like what is it of this particular area that would inspire so many writers and readers to make their home there. She suggested that, you know, in addition to the anchors of the institutions there, that there would be something about the history of it that really people draw from. And so one of that would be the fact that it has a lot of Southern influences. Kalamazoo, like a lot of towns in Michigan, was the center for like a migration up north. And she feels that there's a lot in common with, you know, Michigan writing, Midwestern writing, that it has a lot in common with Southern writing, you know, and she said in the way that, you know, the fiction treats their fiction treats their eccentrics and also in their sense of place, you know, just having a really like deep sense of place. She was also suggested that perhaps it something about the uncertainty of living here, like Kalamazoo, like a lot of, like every community in Michigan really has, you know, gone through some hard times, you know, with the recession and the auto industry and all these things. And the fact that that brings such a deep level of questioning into the lives of so many of us, that perhaps that's something that feeds into great art.
Great art doesn't come from being too comfortable.
Absolutely. You know, you got to be like very alert, have a sense of wonder and a sense of open-endedness. And I think there is a lot of that in Kalamazoo.
What kind of reaction did you get from your story in the Free Press?
I was really interested in the reaction to it. There is a lot of a strong response to it. I think a lot of folks were excited to see what they already knew to be true. I think a lot of other folks, including those beyond Michigan, were very interested in being like, oh, here's perhaps another place that I could live a creative life. I mean, there's a lot of talk among writers and artists about how difficult it is to do what you do best when you're, you know, spending almost all your income on rent. There's a lot of talk about how, like, you know, traditional artistic centers like New York City have been taken from us. You know, they are not a place you can live as an artist who does not have like substantial resources, you know. And so I think a lot of folks are very interested in alternatives to that. We've seen a lot of that in Detroit, where I make my home and where we got a lot of attention for like the Write a House program to give away houses to writers. And I think, you know, writers are also interested in these kind of like mid-sized cities like Kalamazoo, where there's a vibrant literary culture, but it's also is affordable and it provides a lot of other advantages to make sure that you can, you know, devote your resources to your art and not so much just trying to make it kind of
just
work.
Just trying to stay afloat and keep your head above water.
It's hard. It's hard.
Writer Anna Clark, her recent piece in the Detroit Free Press entitled Kalamazoo Quietly Emerging as a Literary Hotspot. So giving respect to Kalamazoo for the kind of writers and readers that it has. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm honored. Thank you.
32 years ago, the state legislature created the Library of Michigan. Its mission, to collect and preserve Michigan publications, to conduct reference and research, and to support libraries statewide. For the past 10 years, Michigan's state librarian has been Nancy Robertson, but she's stepping down and retiring this week. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Your time as the state librarian certainly covered, we'll say, an interesting and very historic time in Michigan with the Great Recession. We saw cuts made to state departments across the board. What did the recession and those cuts mean to the Library of Michigan?
Well, that was a rather difficult time for everybody here, and we really got hit with big cuts to our operating budget and to the number of staff that we could have, and also the state aid to public libraries line that still continues to be under us. And so that dropped from $12 million to $10 million and down below $6 million. And the staff, we were cut by a third, I think, and our operations was cut by a quarter. So we had to rethink ourselves in a big way and downsized what we do and streamlined our focus onto serving Michigan government, to serving the libraries of the state, and to focusing on collecting and preserving and making accessible the published record of the state and its people. And it was a big, yeah, a big change, and it made a lot of people unhappy, and it was very difficult for the staff. And so I really have to commend my staff for weathering that and coming out smelling like roses, because we're doing really well right now.
Well, I wondered how close you are to getting things kind of back up toward pre-recession levels and activities.
Yeah, I think like a lot of places, when they are forced to cut down, they don't really go back to what staff level they had before, because they figure out, you know, to be more lean and mean and really do the things that matter that aren't going to be covered by somebody else. So we've gotten to the point where we've, I think the staff have really embraced sort of our new direction. Our customers have also, and so we are going to be able to grow and add more staff. But what we're going to do is bolster what we're doing now and not add back what we were doing before.
Yep. I think it's a lesson learned all across Michigan.
Yes.
Nancy, in an age where it seems that we consistently turn to our smartphones and our tablets to seek out information, what's your view as to the future of libraries and of books that you hold in your hand?
Yeah, I think the future is still bright for both libraries and books. I know people, and I'm one of them, you know, when I go to bed at night, I'd rather have a real book. During the day when I'm traveling around or moving around town, I like to have my e-book or my iPad or my phone. But as far as the e-information goes, it seems, you know, people have a perception that, well, now we can just go to Google and we don't need libraries. But libraries and librarian professionals who know how to navigate all of this data that's out there online, they're experts in that. And businesses still need help with that. And educators need help with that. And everyday people need help with that. And the library in your hometown is a gathering place for people who matter in your community. And so I think that, in a way, you know, libraries are leaving some of what they've done behind in order to grow, sort of like we have, in new ways, and they're really focusing on what their communities need and what their service population need, and it's still important to provide those services.
Do you think pursuing a career as a librarian is something that is a viable thing to for young people to think of as they are searching for their life's work?
Oh, I do. You know, none of us in libraries went into it for the money, but as a career, it's very rewarding. And, you know, people are enjoying their lives as librarians, and there are a lot of people coming up. We're lucky to have two library schools in the state of great quality, and there's lots of different directions to go if you go into librarianship as your master's degree. You know, you can go into the archives, you can go into actual collection development, you can go into the information technology aspect of it and the information literacy aspect. There's a lot of different ways to sort of channel your energies through librarianship that I think a lot of people don't really know about till they get into it.
Nancy Robertson is retiring after 10 years serving as Michigan's state librarian. Enjoy your retirement, Nancy, and thank you so much for talking with us. It was great to say goodbye to you, and thank you for your service.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you so much for thinking of me.
Okay, so libraries need to be on the watch for new ways to serve their consumers. Well, the University of Michigan's Shapiro Undergraduate Library appears to be taking that advice to heart. The library, known to students on campus as The Ugly, has unveiled a brand new napping station. Here to tell us more is Steve Griffiths. He's a senior supervisor for the library. Steve, where did this idea come from?
So, Cindy, the idea actually came from the students, specifically Central Student Government approached the library and said that they have heard from students that they would like to have a napping station in the library. So, of course, we thought, a napping station, what's that?
So did we.
They submitted a proposal to us and talked about what they thought it could look like. They actually conducted surveys with students to see if, you know, there was interest in a napping station and what their primary concerns would be with something like that. They brought in a professor of neurology, Shelley Hirschner, who works with college sleep disorders, the College Sleep Disorder Clinic, and she, you know, brought us some really interesting information about, you know, the positive effects that a brief nap can have on alertness and academic performance. So when Central Student Government brought us this idea, we decided to, you know, see if we could implement it. And sure enough, it turned out it was pretty simple.
So give me an idea what it looks like. You put it in kind of a quiet corner of the library?
Actually, here's the trick. So our operation is actually 24/7, and it's a really busy library. So last week, for example, you know, it is exam time. We had approximately 60,000 visitors to our just this one building.
Wow.
So our primary concern with a napping station is when a student is asleep, and we've actually seen this before because, of course, students are tired. They're, you know, they're spending all of their time studying and working and doing extracurricular activities. So we see students passing out in the library all the time, just at their tables that they're studying at. And, you know, our concern there is, you know, they're not alert. You know, their laptop could be, you know, sitting in their backpack.
Sure.
So, you know, sometimes we go around and actually wake students up when they're alone because we just want to make sure they're okay. Because if somebody's out cold, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, there's nothing wrong.
Definitely.
So our trick with this was actually to not put it in a quiet area. We put it off to the side on the first floor. And the reason we did that was because, one, it's a very visible area. And the idea is it's safer to have something like a napping station in an area that has a lot of people in it. It's also near to library staff, and we check on it regularly just to make sure that the students who are taking a nap are okay.
Yeah, because you don't want somebody conked out and being there for hours.
Exactly, and that's the thing, is that it's not a sleeping zone. It is a napping station with, you know, with the idea that a brief nap, you know, 10 to 30 minutes is the best thing for, you know, for improving alertness and performance.
Now, I have to ask you, what about the pillows, health concerns, germs?
So, like I said, the cots that we have there now, which the students seem to really like, they're very simple, but they are vinyl, and we have sanitary wipes that students can wipe down before they nap. We also have pillows that have disposable pillowcases.
Oh, like you'd see in a doctor's office.
Exactly. So we've got those. So it's kind of self-monitoring. You know, if somebody wants to take a nap, they can change up the pillow. They can wipe down the cot. And so far, that seems to be working.
And I would suspect other libraries are watching what you're doing, because if it's working for you, it could work for them.
I would hope so.
I have one more question.
Sure.
Can you put one here at Michigan Radio, please?
Sure. We'll bring one on down.
Steve Griffiths, Senior Supervisor for the Shapiro Undergraduate Library at the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us, Steve.
Thanks a lot, Cindy.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was perhaps the worst-kept secret in recent business history. And today, Ford Motor Company announced it to the world. CEO Alan Mulally is retiring July 1st. As expected, his successor will be COO Mark Fields. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes sat down with Ford's executive chairman Bill Ford shortly after this morning's announcement. And Daniel, before we get into your conversation with Ford, I wanted to talk about the timing of the announcement, because a couple of weeks ago we heard it was coming, then Alan Mulally seemed to walk it back a few days after that, and then we have today's announcement. So was the cat just too far out of the bag for them to keep it quiet any longer?
Well, Alan tends to be a Walker backer. I mean, that's kind of been his history. Until it's a done deal and they're ready to announce something, he's not going to be the one to confirm things. But, you know, they had said he would stay through the end of 2014. You know, they had a couple things happening here. One is they have the annual meeting a week from today. And two is I think they wanted to have a period of transition that coincided with the second half of the year. Alan just felt like people were ready. They talked about that this morning in the press conference, that he and Bill concluded that the team was ready, that Mark was ready, and that the team was behind this transition, and it was time to do it. And Alan, I think, is ready to move into retirement. He's very coy about what he may do next. I would expect he may be on a board or two or some other things, and he will be mentioned for some vacancies as they come up around the country, I suspect. But he's also leaving the Ford board upon his retirement.
Okay, so he's basically bowing out and giving the reins to Mark Fields.
Exactly right.
As you talk to Bill Ford, I'm wondering, was there any indication that Ford looked outside the company for a new CEO the way they did with Mullally before they settled on Fields?
They did. They felt like they had to do that to do their due diligence. And I think the preference of Bill Ford and certainly the family was to go with an insider if that insider was strong enough. And they came to the conclusion that they felt Mark was. He really had worked with Alan from the beginning of Alan's arrival. Mark was running the Americas at the time and was really involved in putting together a North American turnaround plan that got turbocharged and refined under Mullally's leadership. But they've been working together for some period of time, and I think they feel very good about this. Bill Ford is especially proud of the transition, and he made the point to me that this company has had terrible problems with chaotic transitions going all the way back to Henry Ford.
They have, that's
and
true.
And if you think about, you know, how Bill Ford became CEO when Jack Nasser got fired and the, you know, some of the turmoil surrounding previous CEO exchanges, This is really a first for Ford Motor Company, and you can tell that Bill Ford is particularly proud of that. And I think it's very important to him that they're able to do that. And he even said that he will be working with Mark going forward, continually refining leadership, looking at succession, do we have the best people, and asking those questions because he thinks this is something they need to do going forward. And I think it is a testament to the Ford board and to Bill Ford's leadership that they have been able to do this so smoothly compared to their crosstown rival who's had, what, five CEOs in 5 years?
Yes, exactly. And it's I guess it's also proof positive, lest anyone wonder about Bill Ford thinking of having that Ford family name at the top, that he's at peace with having a different name.
Oh, I think he is. I don't think, you know, the story of him stepping aside is well chronicled, but in a nutshell, I think he came to the conclusion, given what Ford was facing in 2006, that he wasn't the guy, and he didn't have the tools, and he knew it, and he stepped aside, and they went after Alan. They almost didn't get him. Then they had him, then they lost him again, and then they got him. And the rest, as they say, is history, and it's been a remarkable thing to watch. And I think what's important for listeners in Michigan to understand here is that this is really a Michigan success story. This was a guy who came in from the outside, from another industry, and basically did this turnaround with Ford people. He didn't bring in a bunch of people from the telecoms or from aerospace or from other places to show them how to do things. He basically helped them work together and pointed everybody in the same direction, and they got a lot accomplished.
And when you realize that was the automaker that did not have to get the government bailout, so he sailed them through some very rough shoals.
Yes, he did. But their timing was impeccable. I mean, they were able to get, as they call it, a $23 billion home improvement loan before the markets went south. So they had those lines of credit, and they were able to weather a very tough storm. And it wasn't easy, and it was harrowing at times, but they survived.
And we've seen now this identical pattern at both Ford and GM with two outsider CEOs brought in when things were in peril with Dan Akerson at GM and Mullally at Ford. And now they're retiring and being replaced by folks who are essentially company lifers in Mary Barra and Mark Fields. So what are your thoughts as to what this means for the future direction of these two automakers?
Well, I think that it is true that they are lifers, and so you have to accept the fact that there's going to be some of that older culture down in the DNA. But both Mark and Mary, in their own ways, are viewed, I think, by people inside their respective companies as change agents or people that have really embraced the notion that these companies have to change and have had to change to be successful and to kind of have rebirth. And I think one of the questions you're going to have about Mark Fields are they going to revert back to some of the old ways? Now, he spent a lot of time in the press conference this morning talking about, we're just getting started with this. We have a lot to build on, thanking Al Mulally for giving them this transformed company that they can use to build on. And I think you have, in a different way, you have the same thing with Mary at General Motors. I mean, GM is a very different kind of company today than it was, and it's got some very difficult things that it's soldiering through that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, I think the building blocks probably for GM are there. I mean, despite all of this turmoil, their sales are up more than Ford's are, I believe, in the last month. And that's really surprising because April was a terrible news month for General Motors.
It was indeed. I want to get your thoughts, Daniel, looking ahead after July 1st. Mark Fields is the mm-hmm. new CEO. What do you see as his greatest challenges?
Well, number one, I think he has to be able to convey by what he does, not what he says, that, in fact, he is going to continue what Alan has done at Ford. There's a famous story at Boeing that after Alan left the commercial aerospace division, his successor decided to, just because this is what a lot of human beings do, they wanted to change things and do things differently. And they started to drift, and Boeing has had some real problems. So I think people are going to look to see if Mark, in fact, does what he says, and that is he going to continue to lead in a way that emulates the Mulally style, or at least the process? Maybe the style will be a little different, but Mark talked a lot about positive leadership, and Alan's always been a kind of a positive leadership guy as opposed to constantly wanting to remind people who's the boss.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the first thing I would look at. The second thing is they've got some trouble spots in other parts of the world. You know, they're catching up in Asia. Russia is problematic for everybody right now. It's supposed to be a growing market. Who knows where that's going to go? And they have in 2015, next year, they've got negotiations with the United Auto Workers that I think are going to be critical for the very reason that Ford Motor Company, as well as the other companies, are making money again. And you're going to have a real sentiment within the UAW of, we want it back. We want ours back. You know,
we gave when times were tough.
That's right. There's going to be a lot of pressure for base wage increases. And I think that's legitimate, given the fact that they haven't had one since going back to, I don't know, 2007 or so. They have had much fatter bonuses and profit sharing. But I think you're going to get some push there. So how he negotiates that is also going to be something to watch. You know, Alan was very adept at cutting deals and basically saying, if you give me certain things that help us be competitive, we're going to build cars and trucks right here in the good old U.S. of A. And they pulled products out of Mexico and brought them here. And I think that's going to be something that Mark will probably try to emulate.
Any talk about Lincoln?
No. I think Lincoln is still on yet another attempt at transformation. It's still very much behind the other luxury marks, including Cadillac, by the way. You know, Ford has resisted putting massive multi-billion dollar investments in Lincoln, having special platforms and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has been a detriment. Now, the cars look a lot better than they had in the past, I think, design-wise. Ford has the capability to do this. It's really a question of whether they want to, how much of an investment they want to make in it. And now I think Lincoln has still got a ways to go before we see if the new Lincoln is any much better than the old Lincoln.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive.
It's the sound of science.
If you have traveled by plane and zipped across time zones, you know it, jet lag. Now, there are tricks to try and keep jet lag at bay, but now science appears to have a quicker fix. Thanks to University of Michigan researchers, there's an app for that. It's called Entrain. It crunches numbers to help you minimize jet lag. We're joined by Daniel Forger, who's professor of mathematics and computational medicine. Welcome, Daniel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're joined by Olivia Walsh. Olivia is a PhD student in applied mathematical biology and, of course, both of you with the University of Michigan. So good to have you here, Olivia.
Very happy to be here.
So before we talk about the app and how it works, Daniel, recap for us just what it is that's happening when we get to our dream trip and we feel just foggy and hazy. What is jet lag?
So in the center of your brain, there's actually a clock that tells time like a watch. It's an inaccurate clock, and every day it has to get signals from the external world to synchronize it with or entrain it to the external rhythms. And what happens is when you move quickly across a time zone, this clock is still back in the old time zone, and it takes a long time, usually about one day per hour of time zone shift, for that clock to get readjusted to the new schedule.
So if you're doing one of those really big, like if you're going to Australia, you're going to Asia, you really are getting that clock all discombobulated.
Oh, sure. And it'll take about 2 weeks, scientific studies show, by the time that your performance is really up to normal and you're back in shape.
And you're probably back home by then, and then you have to go through it all over again. So, Olivia, tell us then what Entrain can do, what this app will do to help minimize that jet lag.
Danny and another graduate student published a paper recently that has these schedules of light and dark. And those schedules are designed to get you adjusted to a new time zone in the least amount of time. And the app gives you those schedules. You put in where you want to go to, and you put in when you're going to arrive, and it tells you, okay, be in the light now, be in the dark then. And it can push your clock to the new time zone faster than any previously published method.
So let's just say, in fact, I went to the Apple App Store and I downloaded the free app, by the way. We'll say this, and you guys are not app developers. This is science, and you realized, hey, I could take my science here and all this work I've done and turn it into something that people could really use.
Yeah, I mean, we've been really surprised at how many people have taken to this. We were, I think, when the weekend after it came out, we were the number 6 or 7 travel app above any airline and many other apps you've certainly heard of before. We brought this to the public because we wanted them to be able to access this research, not to have to read through 80 pages of mathematics, which would take you an entire trip to do.
And would never understand. I'm telling you that.
but the other thing, so another couple innovative aspects of the app are, one is we want to know what you're actually doing, because a lot of research in this area is done in carefully controlled laboratory experiments. Mm-hmm. But in the real life, you know, people are doing very different things. So we created the app because it gives you the opportunity to send the data, your data, anonymously back to the University of Michigan. And this way we could see what people in the real world are doing, you know, as they go across time zones and how they're using this information. And people have really latched onto this idea to help us with the science. We thought we would have, you know, 50, 100 people helping us out. And that would have been wonderful. I mean, now we're, you know, at 50,000, 70,000. It's been amazing.
How many downloads have you had since this thing went up?
We're at a little bit more than 60,000, which is impressive considering I was expecting only my mom and dad.
It's like, mom and dad, I've done an app. So, all right, we are going to be taking a trip later this year to Germany and France, and it's going to be the bucket list trip. And I do want to be as sharp as I can. We go to Ireland frequently, and my cure is just to stay up for sometimes 40 hours just trying to get on. I force myself. It's not the best way to do it. So how would I use this? I've got this in here. How much time before I leave on a trip would I want to start training my brain?
It's entirely what you want to do. Some people want to be adjusted by the time they get there. Maybe they have a really important meeting right after they land. In that case, you might want to say you're arriving in the app a couple of days before you actually are. On the travel page on the app, you schedule trips and you put in where you're going and the arrival time and the destination. If you want to adjust once you get there, maybe your schedule in your current time zone is fixed, then you can just put in when you are planning to arrive and it will start adjusting you then.
So if I could add a little bit to that, another innovative feature of the app is people have created very sophisticated mathematical models of your biological clock. And this is used by the military, used by NASA, the transportation industry, but not really used by the common person. And one of the great things about this app is that it simulates those models on your app directly to give you access to all that technology. So the other thing that allows you to do is you could decide how rigid you want to be. If you're an Olympic athlete, you know, you want to follow that schedule right on course. If you're just going for a pleasure trip, you know, you may decide the app says I should go to bed at 8 p.m. when I go to Europe, but I want to stay up and I want to, you know, go have a nice dinner and other things. So you just do that and put that into the app and it will recalculate the schedules.
So this app is going to tell me when I should be getting up, when I should be exposed to light, when I should call it a night and be
in darkness.
Yeah, and that's where the paper and the science become really interesting. When we began this, we thought it would be very complicated for you to go in the best possible way from one time zone to another. You would have to regulate how much light you got every minute and so forth. And the great thing about mathematics is you never know what the answer is until it's all over. And the answer came out to be very simple. All you have to worry about if you want to get to the time zone in the quickest way is just your dawn and your dusk. So long as you just worry about what time of the day you start getting light and get as much light during that time as possible, and when you want to avoid light, you know, like at night, and so long as you regulate those two things, you're doing the best you possibly can.
Entrain, Entrain. It's a free app available from the Apple App Store, but coming soon for Android. They're working on that now. Daniel Forger is a professor of mathematics and computational medicine, and Olivia Walsh, PhD student in applied mathematical biology with the University of Michigan. Thank you so much, and I've got it ready. And as we get closer, how much time in advance? 2 weeks? 1 week?
Just a couple days.
Couple days.
Yeah,
before.
Yeah. All I'm right. happy to walk you through. We can schedule a fake trip right now and then cancel it.
All right. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, wonderful.
And before we go today, a story of...
Bacon! I love you. I love bacon. I love you. I love bacon. I love you. I love bacon. I love you.
And tomorrow, spectators and runners at the Kalamazoo Marathon who enjoy and love bacon can stop by the bacon station for a slice or two. This idea began 3 years ago when a group of neighbors in the Winchell neighborhood in Kalamazoo decided to have themselves a bacon cook-off at the halfway mark, mainly for spectators. But no surprise, with the scent in the air, it quickly caught on with the marathon runners themselves. So now grabbing a piece or two of bacon in the midst of the marathon appears to be a tradition. This year, the group said they'll fry up about 30 pounds of bacon for the event. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.